Welcome back to another episode of the Wavebreak Podcast. Today on the show, we've got an awesome episode for you with Steven Sashen. But before we get into that, I'm Dylan, I'm your host, I'm the founder of Wavebreak, and we help Shopify stores maximize their email revenue. Every week on this show, I interview the people behind the top stores in e-commerce and get them to share their secrets. If you're enjoying the podcast, subscribe on iTunes, or you can sign up for our podcast email list in the show notes below. This episode is brought to you by Wavebreak, my e-commerce email marketing agency that works exclusively with Shopify and Shopify Plus stores. If your email marketing is underperforming, maybe you don't have time or you don't know what to do, or maybe it's a combination of the two, at Wavebreak, we help Shopify stores maximize their email marketing revenue. Black Friday is coming in hot, and if you want to improve your email marketing, you can schedule a call with me, Dylan, me personally, by going to wavebreak.co to learn more. That's wavebreak.co. Now, today, Steven and I are talking about how, well, it's hard to hire a good marketing agency. There's so many horror stories, maybe you've been one, but if you can find a great marketing agency to work with, you can take your business to the next level. Now, we've all worked with people, we've all worked with bad marketers and bad agencies and bad designers and things, and we've all had an experience like that, or maybe you're lucky and you haven't, but we've all worked with somebody where it's just like, man, you're not pulling your weight. Like, are you trying to screw me? But anyway, today on the show, me and Steven, he runs a 7-figure online store called Zero Shoes. Awesome store. He works with multiple marketing agencies, and today he's peeling back the curtain and he's sharing how he finds them, vets them, and more. And specifically, he shares the 3 questions that you should ask a marketing agency before you hire them to avoid becoming another horror story. He also shares some other things about his hiring strategy, as well as many great behind the scenes tips that he's learned along the way building a 7-figure e-commerce business. So without further ado, let's hop into this episode. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Steven. To get started, like, what is Zero Shoes? Can you tell me a little bit about Zero?
So yeah, the thing I like to say is this: imagine it's the end of the day and maybe you've been on your feet all day or just at work all day. You come home, you kick off your shoes. Do you feel better with your toesies out and free? Because if you do, you've been wearing the wrong shoes. Or ask yourself, have you ever accidentally gone to bed still wearing your shoes because you forgot you were wearing them, not because you were passed out drunk? If you have, then, or if you haven't, better, then you've been wearing the wrong shoes. And so Zero Shoes are what we like to say, life-changingly comfortable. And what makes them that is they're designed to work the way feet work. I mean, the technology in Zero Shoes predates technology, predates science, predates footwear. It's just your feet, which are this incredible miracle of design. They're made to bend and flex and move and feel the world. You have a quarter of the bones and joints of your entire body are in your feet and ankles, and more nerve endings in the soles of your feet than anywhere but your fingertips and your lips. So you're supposed to use these things, and that's what feels good. And so we make shoes and sandals that let you do that. They're super lightweight. They're super flexible. They have a nice wide toe box so your little piggies can spread and relax. They're low to the ground for balance and agility. The sole, which is a patented Feel True sole, gives you the protection that you need, but also the ground feedback that your brain wants so that it knows what's happening at the other end of your body, and so it can control everything between the top of your head and the bottom of your feet. And we have both casual and performance shoes and sandals that people use, people all around the world, 97 countries, use for everything from taking a walk to hanging out with friends to running 256K, 7-day stage ultra marathons across Madagascar and everything in between.
Wow, that was an incredible intro. If you're listening to this, the big takeaway I had from that was, okay, one, they make life-changingly comfortable shoes, but yeah. Two, did you guys hear how he said that? He didn't just say, oh yeah, we sell shoes. It's like, here's the problem, here's what's possible, and then here's the path to get there. That's the formula, and you hit it right on the head.
Pretty much. Yeah, it really, you know, I got to tell you something. For a while, I was a little reluctant to start at the top of that story, if you will, about the comfort part. In because when, what happened, the way Zero Issues came about, we started out in the very end of 2009, and for the first few years, we were selling a do-it-yourself sandal making kit where you could make sandals based on a design that was about 10,000 years old. And because we started with the whole barefoot running boom, and that was our customers, people into barefoot running, I was a little myopic. I was seeing things through that lens for quite a while, and it took me till I realized that when you look at mattresses like Casper and Purple and Sattva, and I mean, there's a jillion of them now, their ads are interchangeable. You could literally take any one of their ads and replace the product with one of the other products, and you wouldn't be able to tell the difference for all practical purposes. They're all selling the same story because it's what people want, which is a comfortable night's sleep, a good night's sleep. And I realized that we're doing the same thing. I mean, we have, oh my God, so many testimonials from people who said, oh, these things have totally changed my life, or, oh my God, they're so comfortable, I forgot that I was wearing them, that I realized we needed to move, let's call it up the funnel's food chain, to the top of the funnel, to tell the big picture, which is that these things are crazy comfortable. That's what people are looking for. They want healthy, comfortable feet. And then the question is, how do you frame that in a way that makes it clear what we're doing that's unique compared to other people? And that story's still evolving. I'd love to be able to do it in five sentences fewer than what I just said.
Yeah, but man, that's fantastic. That's so smart. I think too many, it's easy to get caught up in like, oh, here are the features, here are the specs. Like,
oh yeah, yeah, yeah. No one cares.
the shoes are this long, they're this diameter, they're made out of this. Shipping takes this long. It's like, okay, great product description, but people have problems and your product solves that problem.
Well, sometimes they don't even have a problem per se. Like the thing with footwear, there's a lot of reasons people might want footwear. Many of them have nothing to do with the problem. Or let's just say the problem can be unusual. It can be, I need a shoe for a wedding, or I need shoes for, just style. You know, I want to look a particular way. I want to feel a particular way. And those are not the same kind of problems that many marketers think about, where it's, no one is necessarily searching for, well, actually they are searching for, I need wedding shoes. But when you're dealing with an aspirational lifestyle product, which is what we have, the quote problem solution thing is very different. And sometimes because people come to our product for so many different reasons, we can't necessarily use the same story in a way that makes everyone feel like they've come to the right place. So that's the aspirational part. What you're doing in many cases there is giving people an opportunity to be part of your community. And it just so happens that the community includes whatever your product is. So if you think about Nike right now, I mean, that's an extreme example. I don't like giving examples from companies that are completely unprecedented and unique, and in many ways they are. But people don't go to Nike to look for solutions to specific problems. They go there because they know they want shoes, and they know they want to be part of and seen as part of that community, that kind of person, whatever that is. So that's a different kind of problem solution. It's an identity problem solution, if you will. And that's a whole other game than we help you write resumes faster or whatever simple thing you might find, where it's very definable and very easy and you can qualify people instantly.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, you think of like, there's so many brands out there in the direct to consumer space that are selling like $10-$20 products that they buy, they import from China, and they flip them for like $150-$200,
right?
Because they've
right.
created this brand that everyone's buying into.
Yeah, well, you know, let's back up outside of shoes. Think about clothing. I'll start with shoes. My wife said something that we now use at the beginning of almost any pitch that we do, which is, there's so many shoe companies out there, there's no reason to start another unless your shoes change people's lives. And if you think about clothing, you know, why would you buy clothing from Prana rather than The Gap, or vice versa, or Old Navy rather than, I don't know, Nordstrom? I mean, some of it you can identify based on price point. People are looking for clothes and they don't want to spend as much money. Some of it's going to be based on the, again, identity piece of the puzzle. Who do you want to be seen as? My line is, a lot of people do things they dress to express their personality. I wish we all had the same clothes and you just had to have a personality. That would be much more interesting. But people do these things for very different reasons, and it's important to identify. You just made me think of something. I was at a trade show. We were across the aisle from a company, and I said to them after 3 or 4 days of being right in front of them, you know, if I took down your sign, I would have no idea what you did or why your shoes were any different than anybody else's, because they look exactly like everybody else's. And their response was, yeah, we make shoes exactly like everybody else and sell them at a much lower price point in lower markets. And I said, well, that's really interesting. You've solved a seeming need, but boy, that's not a business I would want to be in.
No, yeah. The last thing I want to compete on is price.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's, I'm okay with competing on price to a certain extent. Our products are less expensive than our competitors, but I wouldn't want to race for the bottom. I wouldn't be the idea that the only thing that's unique about what we're doing is price, even if it's high, frankly, I'm just not, that's just not exciting to me.
Yeah. Like, anyway. I would like, it's like cheap and better versus just cheap. Like, you don't want to be the just cheap.
Yeah. And the flip side is equally true. I know people who sell products that are no better than ours by any stretch of the imagination, and they're selling them for 3 to 5 times the price that we are. And they're getting business because, in part because they're charging so much money, they're catering to a very different clientele. And again, I get that. I understand that. That's just so not interesting to me. It gives me literally a bad taste in my mouth when I think about selling something at a super high price point that's really no different than the lower price point product, just so you can target that higher income market. I'm not a fan of doing things just for marketing reasons. I'm not saying that there's not a reason to do it or anyone shouldn't. It just doesn't work for me. For me, Lena and I have made the potentially bad business decision that we develop and sell our products at prices that make sense to us. And you know, there are arguments to be made that we're complete idiots for doing so. But if you're going to spend as much time as we spend in our business, it's good to be, let's say, intellectually and emotionally congruent.
Yeah, totally. So like whenever you're coming up, so if you guys come up with the prices like that, like what's your process for figuring that out?
It's an interesting question. We don't have, I'm trying to think of the best way to describe this. Some of it is, as we're developing products, we're either doing things that are filling holes in our product line. Our goal is to have a product that anyone could wear at any time that gives them that fun and benefit of natural movement, of using your body the way it's supposed to be used. And sometimes we know we're missing something because we're just aware of what we're doing. We know what the different options are for footwear. Sometimes customers ask. We put out this one particular product this year called the TerraFlex. It's a trail running shoe. The moment it came out, I knew this was going to happen. People were saying, that's cool. Can we get a high top waterproof version of that? And so we said, sure. And so we're developing that. And then the pricing, some of it is just based on the simple math of what's it going to cost to make that thing and what margins do we need to make that viable for us? And does that pricing fit with the customers that we have? So we've gotten a lot of requests for a particular type of shoe that if we made it, we'd have to sell it for about $250 because it's really expensive to make. That's just not our customer base yet. So that's a piece of it as well. And then when we do wear testing, if we poll our list of investors or a list that I have called our inner circle list, these are customers who are some of our best customers, we'll show them the product and say, so what do you think? What do you think an appropriate price will be? And we just try to use that information to see if we're thinking in the same ballpark. And we don't often say, what price would you pay for these? Sometimes we'll say, well, what do you think these would sell for if they were in a store? What do you think a neighbor would pay for them? How much would be too much if you were recommending the shoe to someone? There's a lot of ways of playing with that question to get information that's more or less accurate. And then we put all that together and kind of spit something out that makes sense for us, and we see how it does.
Nice. I like that a lot. That's smart. Especially asking people, I like the way you ask the question, how it's not like, hey, how much would you pay for these? Like, how much do you think a neighbor would pay for these? Because otherwise you get the people saying like $5, like give them to me for cheap. Because it's like, I know what you're doing. $5, all right? Give me the shoes for $5.
Well, I like when people respond, you know, if we have a product that we think is going to be $50 and they respond going, I think it's about a $200 product. It's like, all right, well, we are definitely selling this to you.
Yeah, for sure. It's like segment that person, add that person to the list.
Yeah. You're going to see a whole different website than anybody else.
Yeah, there you go. Zero Shoes Premium. No, but No, but like jumping back a little bit, like speaking of Zero Shoe, is it like, so you're coming up with these pricing strategies, like what does your role look like at Zero Shoes now? I mean, you've been in business for almost a decade now. What are you doing?
Well, we're at the 8.5 year mark as of right now. Although the first 3.5 years, really, it was just a hobby business. It was, again, we were selling a do-it-yourself sandal making kit. I said to my wife, wouldn't it be nice to have a little business that just took a couple hours a day, just answering a bunch of emails, sending out products? She goes, that's what we have. I went, yep, too bad I can't stay that way. We knew that if we really wanted to help make natural movement the obvious choice for people, the same way that natural food is the obvious choice, that we were making a much bigger commitment than we would be if we were okay with a lifestyle business. We really wanted to do something that I know it sounds hyperbolic, but could change the world. And that's a big commitment. So I'm technically the CEO and Lena is technically the CFO. She also does a bunch of HR things and I do a bunch of marketing things. I've been an internet marketer since 1992. So I'm responsible for pretty much everything that happens on the website of the universe. Now that said, I'm working with maybe 10 different people who are helping with various things like Facebook advertising on the Google platform, SEO, content marketing. I've got to think of what everyone does. Who do I talk to on a daily basis? Oh, our social media team. So mostly what I have the pleasure of doing is finding people whom I've known for a while, who I know are super smart that I now get to work with, or finding new people I haven't known for a while, but who are also super smart that I get to work with. So I'm trying to become more managerial and much less hands-on, which is something that we haven't been able to do for a while because we just needed the cash. We've been a bootstrap company. And we're growing so quickly, 80 to 100% a year since 2014 in particular, that we need every penny we have for inventory for the next year. We keep running out of inventory every year because we're growing so quickly. And that's actually put a crimp on hiring. So we're only now getting to the point where we've got the revenue and the excess cash that I can start really bringing in additional people so that one day I could do this crazy thing called take a day off.
Love it. And so as you're growing now, like you're hiring all these people, like how big's your team now?
Including, so we have the people here in the office, which is in Broomfield, Colorado, between Boulder and Denver. And then we have people in our warehouse, which is down in Denver. And I think there's maybe 8 people in the warehouse and 16 people here at the office.
Nice. So you've chosen to do all of your marketing in-house as you scale up.
Well, to a certain extent, again, you can call it in-house, but the people that I was referring to on our my quote marketing team, none of them actually are in-house. They're all in different parts on the planet. It's funny. I get approached by agencies all the time and they go, hey, you know, we could be your one-stop shop sort of in-house marketing agency. And we do everything. We do PPC. We do SEO. We do content marketing. We do website design. And they give this whole
email, SMS, so on. Pinterest.
We'll buy your mother a Christmas card. You name it. And I go, hey, don't buy my mother a Christmas card. She's Jewish. So, but the thing I say to them is for each one of those little silos of functionality that you described, there's maybe 5 experts in the world. And you don't have any of those people working for you, I guarantee. Because frankly, anybody who's smart enough in any one of those silos, if they're working at a big agency, they're smart enough to realize they could go off on their own, have a small agency, and make more money. And so typically that's who I'm working with, is people who've many of them, I think one or two have never worked for an agency, but a lot of people who at one point were at an agency and went, why am I giving them all my money? And they started out on their own. And ironically, it's one of the reasons why I don't have very many people who do marketing things in-house, because if I got them up to speed on what we're doing, if I helped teach them, if I helped nurture them, that if they were smart enough to do what I want them to do, they'd be smart enough to realize they should quit and start their own agency and work with 3 or 4 people just like me.
Yeah, that's so true. And I really like what you said there too, because that's the approach I've taken with my business, is we do one thing and one thing well. And right now that's email. And I'm not trying to be great at conversion rate optimization and design and all these different things. And sort of like you, it's like I'm just an extension of these other business owners who I do the work for.
Yeah. When I talk to certain potential investors, they go, well, I can't believe you got 10 different people you're working with. I go, yeah, 10 of the best people that I can work with. If I was at an agency, I'd have 10 people working with me, but I'd only be sending one paycheck. What's the difference? They go, well, you could have it in-house. I went, nope, can't do it that way. I point them to this one company that I worked with. The only thing they do is optimize your Google Shopping campaign. That's it. And most people who aren't in the marketing world don't realize how granular some of these things really get. I mean, I'm starting to work with someone, a new vendor, if you will. I don't like that term, but I couldn't think of a better one. A new person, let's use the word person, who is going to be just managing one particular aspect of our Amazon account. And while they claim they could do all the rest of it, I don't care. I just want them to do that one thing because I know that's what they're best at.
Yeah, I really like that too, because I don't know where these people, I don't know about you, Stephen, but I don't have enough time in the day to do everything. So I don't know how these people are doing it all. Like, they're not doing it to the best that it could be.
No, and here's another one. My favorite is when an agency approaches me and they go, well, you know, we're the fastest growing internet marketing agency in wherever location they talk about. I go, oh, well, then I definitely can't hire you. They go, what? I go, well, if you're the fastest growing, that means you need more and more talent every day. And there's only a limited amount of real talent out there. So you're clearly hiring people who are not as smart as I want. And then you're going to make me work with them, which is not going to end well for any of us.
Yeah. While they learn on the job.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Slow and steady wins the race everywhere.
You know, it's funny you say that. I was at a conference that was put on by an investment banking group, and all they work with is consumer products. And one of the keynote speakers was a guy from Bain Capital. And that was exactly his message. He said, look, it used to be that getting to $100 million was hard. But once you could do that, you could get to $500 million easily. Now it's the other way around. It's easy to get to $100 million. You find some celebrity with 5 bajillion followers, and they promote your product, and suddenly you're at $100 million. But the only way to get to $500 million is by having a real business, not one that's a flash in the pan that was successful because of some fluky something. And there's no way around getting there other than hard work and heavy lifting. And it was really reassuring to hear that, frankly.
Totally. And I think that's a lot of times I found myself doing this all last week. And it's one of my big revelations recently. It's like I keep asking questions that I already know the answer to. Like, oh, what's this?
What?
Well, for example, what's this person do to achieve X? Or how do they get more of this? And it's like, wait, I know what they did. They just did the work. They just shut up and they did it. They're not any smarter than me. They're not smarter than you. It's just they sat down and they actually did the work instead of thinking, what are these people doing?
You know, it's so funny. There's two things about what you said that I love. One is we had one of our first employees had his own e-commerce website in a similar niche as ours. And that's why he applied for the job, is he knew our space. And after 6 months, he quit because he said, I suddenly realized why my business wasn't doing well. And we said, why? He goes, because I'm not working my ass off the way you guys are. And that was a great revelation. It was annoying to lose him. But that was part one. And part two of what you said that I love is those other guys, they're doing, how do I want to put it? There's not really much need to spend time paying attention to how they seemingly got to where they got, as if you could figure that out, because you're not them. So yeah, go back and just do the hard work that you know that you have to do for your unique situation. And that's the answer. I mean, someone said to me, hey, we can go meet Richard Branson. I went, why would I want to do that? They went, what? I said, well, I'm not Richard Branson, so what's he going to tell me? He doesn't know anything about my business. So I can't imagine, frankly, he's going to tell me anything that either I don't know or that couldn't be taken care of by just going back and doing the next thing on my to-do list that is going to make me more money.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's one problem with mentors, too, is a lot of times, or books you read, it's like, hey, here's what I did. It's like,
right,
wait, when did you do this? They're like 5 years ago. It's like, okay,
right.
This is the internet. So everything changes every 6 months.
Well, if you haven't read Fooled by Randomness, the subtitle of which is The Hidden Role of Chance in Markets and Life, this is the thing that the author Nassim Taleb talks about, is that so many people think that because they were successful in the past, it was because of them. And then they try to do some new thing in the future. And they think, well, this feels like that first thing, so I'm going to have to be successful doing that. But their success in the first case was often because of things much more than them, much bigger than them. And in the intervening time, like you said, the river has moved on and you're not stepping in that same water. And people don't realize that. The whole phenomenon, when people call me looking for jobs, they go, well, I was the head of marketing at so-and-so and they paid me $5,000 a second. I go, great. I don't really care what you did in the past. I only care what's going to happen with what you do with us now and in the future. And I'll pay you based on performance, not based on what you did in some unusual situation that I can't know anything about, or I can't know the specific details of, because they're long gone.
Yeah. And that's one thing too, where it's like, you have to be You have to be a little cautious with agencies who are like, oh yeah, we helped this business 10x. Well, it's like,
who cares?
While that
who
business cares? Was 10xing, like they were appearing everywhere. They were doing everything they could on their end too. And the agency only helped right. them with their one ad or whatever.
Well, I had this one group approach me with that exact story. And I said, well, the product that these people have, it's another footwear company. I said, yeah, their story is so much simpler than ours. Their story is, here's this same shoe that you've worn for years and years and years, but we're making it with recycled materials. I mean, that is the easiest story in the world. And they were charging a lot of money for a basically plastic shoe that didn't last very long. That's a piece of cake. That's not the situation we're in. We're not selling one style of a shoe with a feel-good green story. You know, that was what made that thing work. I mean, they were disorganized and all the rest, but it's apples and orangutans comparing those to us. The fact that they were in footwear and we are too is irrelevant.
Totally. And now, speaking of, I want to jump back a little bit to the hiring. Like, what's your, so you're bootstrapped. A lot of people who listen to this show are bootstrapped too. And I just want to know, like, what's your strategy for hiring? Like, how do you know what to hire for? And then we can dive into the agency side sort of in, after that.
To a certain extent, it's just been a function of need. So because we're growing as quickly as we are, one of the biggest things is customer service, or what we refer to as our customer happiness team. So we can just tell once they're getting overworked, we need someone else. And we try to be ahead of that curve if we can. It's tricky. We're in Colorado and the unemployment rate is under 2%. So there's not a lot of people. Part of our strategy is paying above average starting wages because we want to get better people who want to be here. Part of our strategy is because we are trying to change the world by making life-changingly comfortable footwear, we want them to know what we're up to and believe in the mission and be part of that mission and be excited by that mission and be excited by being on the ride with us. Part of it is I started way back when. I'm not very good at keeping secrets. In fact, I'm horrible at it. And so I remember saying to an early person who was interviewing with us, let me know. And I said, you know, we're only going to hire people who bang down the door and beg to work here. And in part, that's because my first company, I had a software company way back when, and someone literally did that. I was featured in the newspaper. He found out where I lived and knocked on my door and said, I want to work for you. And I said, I don't think I can afford you. I'm brand new. It's just me. We don't have any money. I'm working out of my second bedroom. And I mean, thanks for checking in. And a week later, he knocked on the door again. He did this like three or four times until a friend of mine who was a business consultant went, trust me, just that kind of tenacity, hire that guy. He'll pay for himself within a month. And that's exactly what happened. He ended up practically running the company. So that was a really good thing. But I thought if I told people that's what I was looking for, it would poison the well and they would just do it because I told them to do it. But amazingly, that never happened. They either demonstrate that they want to be here or they don't. And it doesn't matter what I say about that. So that's another piece of it. And to a certain extent, I'm still learning the answer to that question. We're growing again so quickly that when you hit certain revenue milestones, or well, it's kind of revenue, or it's related to revenue, the business changes. So if we are suddenly in 10 times as many stores, in 10 times as many places, it's a different business than when we were 99.9% e-commerce. And if we are trying to put together deals with, I don't know, some major company or some major sports team or some major athlete or something where there are aspects to the business that are now available to us that weren't previously, some of these things are tricky. And while Lena and I are smart people and we could learn to do them, it would be better to have people who know how to do it. If we're talking about international distribution, there are people who know that way better than we ever will. And as we keep getting requests for international distribution, we need someone who's going to manage that. If we're going to put together a guerrilla marketing team who's just going out and doing every music event or street fair or whatever else we can think of, then hiring someone who knows how to manage that, that's out of our domain. So some of it are things that we're growing into, and we're literally asking that exact question that you asked on a daily basis. How do we figure out who we need, and then how do we find them?
Wow, that's awesome. That's a great answer. And I almost wonder, like, well, I imagine that it's a problem that, like, you continuously solve too. Like, you're never like, this is how we do it. This is our strategy.
Right. No, I'll tell you, there's another part. This one's kind of fun. We have to really make sure that there's a good cultural fit. And that's an easy thing to say and a hard thing to identify and measure. So something that occurred to me recently that that we're, I think we're going to start trying to do this when we interview people and see what happens as a result, is ask people, so if you had this job, what do you want to say on your business card for your title? And we try to ascertain how attached they are to their title. Because if the answer is that they're very attached, we're probably not going to hire them. Not because they're not going to have that title in some amount of time, but because someone who cares that much what it says on their business card is probably a little more political than we want someone to be in a company that's the size that we are and the flavor that we have. You know, everyone's, I think of our company as having a pretty flat hierarchy. There's not some level where, you know, you answer to your manager answers to a senior manager, the senior manager answers to me. And in fact, we never want that kind of company. We want everybody to be involved. And so, you know, someone who gets uptight about whether they're a VP or a chairman of or chief something, probably not a good fit.
Yeah, I think that's a great question to ask too. And another thing that you touched on that I really like is the mission, because people, money only motivates people so much. They want to feel important.
Yeah, yeah. And that's another piece of it as well, is because we are in the bootstrap situation that we are and growing the way we are, we don't pay, let's use air quotes around the phrase, market rates necessarily. Again, for customer service, we're paying more than quote market rates, but on the executive team and the people who are one step further removed from customers, let's say, we're not necessarily paying. Well, here's one. A friend of mine who basically does what I do, he's an internet marketing guy, but he's working for a $1 billion company. He gets paid $300,000 a year to do things that I do, and he's not as good at as I am. He's competent and smart guy and has figured out a lot of great things, but just doesn't know the landscape the way that I do. Hasn't been doing it as long, hasn't ever worked for himself and sold his own products, etc. But the guy's getting $300,000. We can't pay someone $300,000. There's just no way. And because we are A, in a desirable physical location, and B, have a fun corporate culture where people are pretty much walking around barefoot all the time or in our shoes, but it's really low key, and we're very dog friendly, and we would be iguana friendly if someone had an iguana. We'd be sugar glider friendly. We'd be very sugar glider friendly. That would be fun. But the all these factors that we have play into the fact that people are basically taking a haircut to work for us with the expectation and hope, and we hope so too, that they'll be able to do better because we're a growing company than if they were with something that was established where they were getting a higher salary, but it's never going to go anywhere. And they're never going to see some big windfall if the company sells, for example.
Yeah. And that's why you see people jumping from job to job, just chasing their next paycheck too.
Oh man, it is. When I see that, it's just painful to me. It's like,
from both ends, like the employee and the business owner. It's like, man.
Yeah. Well, when I say it was painful, it's definitely painful for us when and if that happens. We had that. We brought someone in who was a smart young guy, and 6 weeks later went, okay, well, I got it. Thanks. It's like, what? So we had lost money on that because of the amount of time it took us to train someone and get him up to speed. But it was also sort of just more sad for him. Like, you're not going to find what you're looking for by just jumping around and crossing your fingers. It takes some time to understand what you're really doing and what value you can provide and to get the rewards back from really contributing to something. You can't do that in 6 weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. And it sounds like you guys are starting to set things up so that you get less of those people and more of the people who are like passionate and driven by your mission and the culture at your company.
Well, that's the hope. But people will say things that you never imagined they would say that turn out to not be true. Or I got to tell you one, we were about to hire someone. We really, really like him. This is a very, very clever person and was totally into what we were doing. And we have to do a background check before we hire anybody. And the background check came back, and this guy had like 5 DUIs. It's like, dude, you knew we were going to do a background check. Why didn't you tell us what happened? Because if you had told us and we had talked about specifically what happened, we probably would have still hired you because we understood the circumstances of how those occurred. But the fact that you didn't bring it up when we explicitly said we're doing a background check, anything that we should know, the fact that you lied and said no, we're done. But it was amazing. Up until that point, we were all on board. And then suddenly we got this bit of information that made it very clear that had we hired this guy, it would have been a massive mistake.
Yeah. And so speaking of honesty and transparency, like a lot of people have been burned by bad agencies and agencies who say they're going to do X and it never happens, or it's just they're not talented, or I mean, there's so many stories that we could get into. But like, how do you find your marketing partners? So you have a lot of those. What's your process for that? Do you have one?
I'm laughing at a couple things. I'll tell you a story first. So way back when I was in the film world and I was on the set of a movie that was being made, the director is a guy named Tony Bill. And I'm on the set for about 5 days. And at the end of those 5 days, I came up to Tony and I said, you know, this set is the most amazing film set I've ever been on. You start on time, you finish on time, you take breaks at the appropriate time, not just because you have to, but because you're able to. I mean, you're done when the break is ready. You I've never heard you yell at anyone. I've never heard anyone else yell at anybody else. I mean, everything gets done smoothly and professionally. How do you do that? Because I've been on film sets that are just nuts. And this is the opposite of nuts. And he said, I've been doing this for 40 years. I just kept firing people until I ended up with the ones who could work the way I wanted. And we don't have that kind of luxury, obviously. But there's two things that I ask people when they're looking to get money from me. One is, how quickly and cheaply can I find out if you have your head up your ass? I mean, I literally say it just like that. And just because it's fun to say, frankly. But I want to know, you know, if it works, I'm going to spend more money. If it doesn't work, I don't want to have a conversation where you say, well, I don't know why that didn't work. Thanks for the cash. And you walk away with my money, which has happened more times than I would like to count. So that's the first thing that I ask. And the second thing I ask is, so if you're wrong, then what? And they go, what do you mean? I go, well, you know, you don't bat 1,000. So if for whatever reason we're not a client that you can help, then what? Are you taking any responsibility for that at all? And most agencies say, no, we can't do anything about that. And I go, well, of course you could. If you did the math, and this is what stock traders do, if they have a system, you analyze the system to see if it has a positive expectancy. If you trade the system accurately and things considered a, or the market stays consistent with the system, then you don't need to win every time. You just need your wins to be the amount you make when you win times the number of times you win has to be bigger than the amount you lose when you lose times the number of times you lose. If you end up with a positive number, then you can just keep trading all day long and you'll make money. It's, you're not going to do it linearly. So I say to these companies, same thing. If you guys knew how much money you made with a good client and how much money you lost with a bad client and did the math on how many good clients you get versus bad clients, if you end up over one, then you could go hunting for your best clients and offer a money back guarantee. And people freak out when I say that. They're like terrified, in part because they're terrified they're going to find out they can't really offer demonstrable, valuable benefits. One company approached me. They had a content marketing strategy, and I loved the strategy. And suddenly I said, but hold on. Here are the keywords you're going after. Here's the monthly traffic that those keywords get. Let's pretend for the fun of it that I can get 50% of that traffic, which is, of course, ridiculous, but let's just pretend. Here's my average order rate. Here's my conversion rate. So if I multiply all these things together, here's how much money I'm going to make by using your strategy. Have you noticed that the amount of money that I'm going to make is less than the amount of money you want to charge me every month? And you could see them just go white because A, they realized that was true for me, but they also realized that was probably true for all their other clients, just the other clients didn't know how to do the math at them. So that's another one. And the third thing, the last thing, is I say, because I'm usually approached by people who want to do something that I'm already doing. And I say, how are we going to test this to see if you're better than what I currently have? And the only way that I'm willing to do it is if we can do a real split test where half the traffic that we get or half the advertising that we're putting out, whatever it is, half of something is them and half of that and the other half is the current solution that I have, because that's the only way to see if one is better than the other. When someone says, well, you know, why don't we just give us 6 weeks and see, well, let's see how we do in 6 weeks. I go, I can't do that. We're such a seasonal business that the next 6 weeks is very different than the previous 6 weeks. And we're growing so quickly and there's so many things happening. It could be that we got mentioned on some massive television show and you're going to take credit for that. And so you've skewed the data. So the only way I can do it is with real split testing. And in a lot of circumstances, there's no way to do that. So that one's a tricky one. Basically, if I'm happy with the results I'm getting, I stay with where I am until someone can show me a very clear path that would try to, that would convince me that there's some other way or some other reason to jump horses or switch horses, whatever that phrase is, without specific split testing data.
Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. I love how you broke it down to like three questions. And I think so many people just kind of like, I think a lot of times, even myself, it's so easy to look at the potential upside of a deal or working with somebody that you don't even want to even look at the bad, like what could go wrong. But it's like, yeah, you got to look at that just as much.
Well, I say more. I do the exact opposite.
Oh, yeah,
I say to people, yeah, I say, I don't really care what you how much money you think I'm going to make. The only thing I can manage, the only thing I can mitigate is risk. So I just need to look at the risk. How much is it going to cost me to find out if you're right or wrong? That's it. And am I willing to lose that amount of money? And there's no way to be right every time. There was a ad campaign we did recently, cost us a couple grand, and we made a couple grand. And if we, and this is my actually one of my favorite things, we spent $2,000, we made $2,000. They said, hey, you broke even. I said, no, I didn't. I have cost of goods. I have the expenses of keeping the lights on and paying people. If I spend $2,000, I better make $6,000 back just to break even. And so by knowing those numbers, that comes in really handy. Most people don't know their numbers well enough to what I affectionately call do the math at someone. We had someone approach us who was a customer, really liked what we were doing, had a massive, massive following on social media and had a huge email list and wanted us to give them a bunch of money to be part of something they were putting on where we could meet other people just like this person. And I said, well, before I can give you that amount of money, let's see if there's any value in what you can bring to the table. So we talked about it and they agreed to do a post on all their social media channels and to send out a solo email on our behalf. And we got 26,000 unique visitors and made 20 sales. And I said, if we'd gotten 26,000 unique visitors in any normal world, that would have been about 700 sales. So clearly your audience is like 13-year-old boys from Bangladesh or something, because there's no there there. And they didn't even know it. They had no idea that their millions of followers were mostly bots and trolls and kids who had no money.
Wow. Yeah. I know. That's another big thing too. Like if you like coming at it from a different angle, not necessarily just agencies, but like your business itself and my business, it's like if you believe in your message, you're not afraid to back it with money. And
yeah.
you'll know your numbers. But if you're one of these people who are like afraid, like these people who don't know what they're charging, they don't even know that they're making you money or that you're losing money hiring them. It's just like, I don't get that.
I don't either, but here's another variation on that. For things, the other thing you want to pay attention to when someone's going to make you money is, where's the money coming from? Is it coming from bringing you new traffic, cold traffic, people that you've never met before? Is it bringing you traffic from, or is it doing something to optimize the traffic you already have? Is it lower down the funnel? Is it, which is something like retargeting or email marketing, is it based on branded terms, things that are already related to the name of your product or your company, or is it non-branded? So if someone says, we're going to do something that's top of the funnel and branded, so people searching for Zero Shoes, something or other, whatever, they're using our name in the search, that I want to pay way less for that than if they're just going after brand new people who don't know who we are in some other way. And similarly, retargeting, I've already spent money to drive the traffic to me. So the return on that has to be much, much higher than cold traffic, because I've got to add the amount of money I'm spending on retargeting to the amount of money that I spent to get the traffic to begin with, to get a sense of what the return on the investment is. And let's be clear, this whole idea of attribution, to figure out what your real cost is, to figure out what your real acquisition cost is, your real cost of selling is not a perfect proposal. There's no way to do it perfectly. It's as much art as science, because we don't have things like a universal cookie that will let us know what everybody has ever done in any way before they buy your product. And that's the only way you could know everything they ever did and how much each one of those things cost to then put all that math together to give you the most accurate answer to the question, what does it cost for me to make a sale?
Yeah. And one thing I've noticed this whole call is what you're talking about. Like, you know the numbers for everything. Like, you know the unemployment rate where you live. Like, you have all the numbers down. And I think when you know I know for a fact, when you know your numbers, there's already less risk, because when you're hiring this person, you already know, like, okay, what sort of ROI am I looking for? If they don't hit it right away in whatever time they say, they're gone. And next guy's in or whatever.
Yeah. And look, I've had to fire people who, or agencies who where I had to say 3 months in a row, I can't figure out if you're making me money or not. You know, you haven't shown me anything where I'm clear that you're making me money at all, let alone more than the last person. And this one agency I'm thinking of in particular, by the time I was able to figure it out, it was really clear that they probably cost me 40 grand.
Ouch.
It was very, very painful. And part of it was just so hard to find out what they were and weren't doing, because it was a very obscure sort of marketing project they were involved in, but they just couldn't get their act together to demonstrate that they were making me money. And so once I said, if you can't prove it at all, whether the answer is yes or no, that you're to making me money, but if you can't answer the question, I've got to fire you.
Yeah. I think that's one of my biggest takeaways from this today, is just like, know your numbers. Like if you don't know your numbers already, which you should, if you're listening to the show, you should know your numbers. But if you don't, like, or if you're just like just drill them in, like understand them, because that's where you get true power. Because now all of a sudden you can spend more on ads or do all these things that you didn't even know before, because you know your numbers, you know where the money is now.
And let's not, I completely agree. And let's not be coy. Sometimes it's hard to go and take a look psychologically, because you may be afraid that you're going to find out it's not working. And I totally understand I don't know what the word is for that, but just that urge to keep your head in the sand, because you just kind of don't want to know, because you hope that things are. But at a certain point, the stress of not knowing will outweigh the stress of finding out if you're wrong, for example, and then you'll take action. But you know, let's not overlook that psychological phenomenon that as humans, we don't want to find out that we're wrong. We don't want to find out that things aren't going well. We're wired to not look that way. And one of the biggest challenges is being willing just to face the facts.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I always think about like the people who haven't gone to the doctor in like 5 years or 10 years, because it's like, oh, why haven't you gone? It's like, well, now I've waited so long that I'm afraid to go.
It's, yeah, same thing.
You're only hurting yourself. And it's the same with your business. Like, so that's your action step today, listeners. Like, if you don't know your numbers, or like figure out that one thing, like what's that thing you're avoiding that you're scared to look at, and just do it. It doesn't even have to be in your e-commerce store, but like in your life, like that's going to be that's my action step for you guys today.
That's a really good one.
But yeah, before we sign off, you've shared a ton of great points and a lot of great advice so far, Stephen. It's been awesome. Do you have any closing thoughts or quick words of advice to end on?
Yeah, go get a government job with a pension.
there you have it, guys. Takeaway. I want to like put that in the beginning. Like, if you don't listen to the entire episode, the big takeaway is get a government job with a pension.
Yeah, and I'm partly serious when I say that, and I'll tell you why. One is I'm 56 years old, and I have friends who had government jobs with pensions who are retiring, and man, it looks pretty damn good. The other is, if something like that makes you think about getting an actual job, then you probably should get an actual job. My dad said to me once, I was trying to get some money from him for something I was doing. He says, why don't you just get a job? I said, that wouldn't end well for anybody involved. And but if you can be swayed. This is not easy. Building a real business is not for the faint of heart. And if you can be swayed, you're probably someone who really, I don't know if this is true, but you know, maybe you shouldn't. And if you're a real entrepreneur, whatever that means, then nothing I'm going to say is going to sway you anyway, even if your idea is completely stupid and you don't know what you're doing. So for those people, it doesn't matter what I say. And for the other people, you know, it's a real consideration. Lena and I, we had an employee who came in one day and said, well, I would want to get some options in the company or get some stock in the company. And Lena said, do you know, Stephen and I didn't take a salary for 3 months last year because we needed to pay everybody else. It's like, okay, never mind. So this is, it's not simple. And honestly, if it is simple, there's a high probability that whatever you're doing is going to be obsolete in a year or two or three, and you're going to have to do it all over again.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, it's like to get through like all the best things in like to get what everyone wants, you have to do what nobody wants to do. That's not mine, but I love that.
Yeah, no, I knew that wasn't yours. Nothing personal, but it really is very true. Or I don't know that nobody wants to, but it's the biggest thing that people overlook or imagine is that somehow this could be really, really easy. And for some people it is, and I can assure you that those are the exceptions, not the rules. But it's there's a lot of hard work and heavy lifting to make anything happen. I remember in the early days, I'd go to internet marketing workshops, and the number one piece of advice was throw away your television. And my number one piece of advice is get a better television, because at the end of a long, hard day, there's nothing better for me than sitting on the couch with my wife and turning off our brain and watching some comedy or some show that we really like and relaxing. I mean, that's the way that we stay alive, is we have dinner and we chill out in front of the tube and watch a movie or something. So the not hard thing the hard thing is legit, and what you need to be able to do to handle that and cope with that and manage that and do that, that's your real job.
Boom, there we have it. So yeah, just get the government job with the pension. Anyway, but yeah, this has been an awesome episode, Stephen. You've shared some awesome info. A lot of great, so much good stuff in here. So many good nuggets. But where can we go if we want to learn more about you and Zero Shoes, and we want to take our feet to heaven early? where can we go to learn more?
Not surprisingly, our website, which is Zero Shoes, X-E-R-O, shoes, plural, .com. And you can find us on social media as well. We're pretty much everything / Zero Shoes.
Boom. There we have it. And I'll link that all up in the show notes below. Thanks so much for coming on the show, Stephen.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Now, listener, before I sign off, stop me if this sounds familiar. Your email marketing is stuck. You feel like you could be doing email better. You're not generating enough email revenue, and you feel like you're leaving money on the table. But you don't have the time to figure email out yourself or do it on your own because you have a business to run. Imagine this. Imagine not having to worry about leaving money on the table with your email marketing. Imagine not having to figure out what to send, when to send it, how many emails should look, what automation you need, what segments you need, how often you should be contacting your email list, or just worrying about sending the next email. You don't have to worry about any of that. Imagine having peace of mind knowing that your email marketing is generating sales in good hands. At Wavebreak, we help Shopify stores maximize their email marketing revenue. That's it. We don't do anything else. And we've created a system called the Wavebreak Method that, number one, makes you less dependent on Facebook or other marketing channels. Let's say something bad happens. Facebook says, see you later, Shopify store, and they just completely kill your ad traffic overnight. You don't have to worry. You don't have to stress because you're good to go because you have a cushion of email revenue. You don't have to worry about what your wife is going to do, or if you're going to be able to make rent, or if you're going to be able to pay people, because you have this cushion of email revenue to rely on. Number two, the second thing this does is huge. And it's how stores scale from 7 figures to 8 figures to 9 figures. And the secret is repeat purchases. The Wavebreak method gets rid of one-time buyers and increases repeat orders. Number three, it keeps your email list engaged. You don't have to worry about Black Friday and beyond. We'll figure out the ideal amount of times that your list needs to be contacted to maximize revenue, and then we'll execute it for you. If you want to learn more about this system and how we can work together to apply it to your business, go to wavebreak.co to schedule a call with me. And I'll personally send you my calendar link and we can chat one-on-one. Now, I don't have unlimited time to do these calls. I can only do a couple of them per week. So if you want to get your call, go sign up at wavebreak.co for it as soon as possible, and we can talk about how we can work together. Thanks for listening to this episode. Subscribe to the show on iTunes to get notified of new episodes as soon as they drop.